Hello.
This is going to be incredibly strange, isn't it? I'm going to try not to look at you the entire time.
Okay, you can
Because this is going to be already quite an awkward recording, made even more awkward if I just keep on staring into your eyes.
I feel like we need to have just like a slight sort of atmospheric, you know, romantic music just under that, staring into your eyes.
Violin somewhere in the background.
Different vibe.
No, different vibe completely.
Today.
Yeah. It doesn't help that I'm exhausted, but
yeah, I think we are you are more so than I, but we are both not wholly mentally fresh.
That's what offsides do to you.
It certainly is.
I always thought that in the wonderful eventuality of me having my own business, that I would not go through the usual pitfalls of big companies and have a exhausting offside. Yet here we are. Maybe capitalism does do something right.
Maybe it does. But I think, and credit to my other half who pointed this out yesterday, for two people who spend most of our time, especially during the week, inside, in an office, yes, we talk to each other, we talk to other people remotely. We're not in the presence of other people and we're not always using our brains at their maximum capacity. For the tasks that we're doing all the time. For 6 hours straight. Including some very good conversations with other people, but even so, some draining conversations. And it's just a lot of socialising, which it is. And it's like an offsite or a sales kickoff when you're like,
yeah.
I just need to go and be in a dark room for a little bit. It's obviously, we should say, and it's probably obvious by now, but we're in the same room for the first time since we started this podcast.
I can touch Paul. That's weird. Let's not do that.
Every time we touch. So, it was right there.
The joke was there, and you took it.
We are, Lydia has been very kind and has driven the length of England, I think, pretty much.
Yeah.
North to south, to come and see me. But to spend some time together doing lots of fun things and lots of... It's one of those things where it's like, we had lots of really exciting conversations about lots of really, really cool things, and we can talk about none of it, really, on here, or at all. And then today... We have this recording, and then we're going to go and explore a little bit of Dorset. And get to be the best thing I always say about having people come to visit is that I get to go and be a tourist at my own backyard.
I can't wait for you to actually return the favour at some point and actually come up north. The north is fun. It's great.
I'm sure it is. I keep hearing how people ask me how far I've come.
for context, and as someone who has lived across England. So when I first came to the UK, like, I was living actually quite close-ish to here, like about an hour away from where Paul is, in a city called Swindon, which, by the way, as per the name, you don't expect much. It was not a fantastic first impression of England, especially, and I think I'm pretty sure I've told you this story. I'm not sure if I told it on the podcast, but I came to the UK for my internship. So this is 7 years ago? 8 years ago, and I flew from Denmark. At the time, I lived in a city called Odense, which is the hometown of Hans Christian Andersen, the fairy tale writer. And as you can imagine, beautiful scenery, lush town, beautiful buildings. Took the incredibly cheap and very well operated DSB, which is the state-owned railway system in Denmark. Went straight into Copenhagen Airport, which is quite lovely. Especially nowadays, I think it's actually nicer nowadays because they did some work on it. Took a flight to Gatwick. from Gatwick, I took one train to central London to obviously make the switch. And then another train from London Central to Swindon. Things got from, I would say, landing in Gatwick to pretty gnarly in London to plainly awful.
If I just track that journey, I mean, okay, you've landed at Gatwick, not even Heathrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not London City or Luton, but still, Gatwick, of all of London airports, it sort of feels like the one that wants to be good, but isn't, and doesn't accept that it's not very good. To then get the train into, of all places, London Victoria, again, not even the nicer of the central London terminals, to then get the train to Swindon... Which, and no offence if anyone listening is from Swindon, but it is not known for its charm.
No,
we say
no. It is a function. It's a functional city, right?
Yes.
And as far as I know the history of it, and I have spoken to folks who are locally from Swindon, but it was practically one of those industrial towns that sort of arose from having a rail going through it, and you can tell. You can tell it's very well organized. Roads are quite wide. You know, it's a relatively easy. It obviously has the infamous magic roundabout. If folks don't know what that is, I highly encourage you Google it. For folks who are used to driving on the left-hand side of the road, it looks like a nightmare. For folks who have never driven on the left-hand side of the road, it looks like a magic incantation. Both of those are true. So that was really like my first impression of England. And then for some reason, I came back. So there must have been something magical in that magic roundabout. But so I've lived across the across England, right? So I've been in Swindon, I've been in Manchester, and nowadays I'm in the northeast. And I already joked with Paul this a couple of times of like, you know, going to the shops around here. It's like, why does nobody ask where I'm from? Why does nobody want to know how I'm doing? Like, why is nobody calling me hun? Right? It's one of those things that, as with most countries, right, there's a big division usually between the north and the south. And my take is that like that division starts very strongly, and this is a very most likely depending on the folks listening, it might be a very controversial thing to say. For me, the north starts from the Yorkshire border and up. That's where north is. And as someone who has been traveling quite often between the north and the south, I do have a great weakness for the north. I just like people are friendly. You may call them nosy, as we were discussing this yesterday. Whilst I just think it's lovely. It's very nice to have people. Not really, you know, but just you feel like people care. You feel like people are curious about you, and you get to have lovely chats from time to time.
Yeah. I lived my first year of uni, one of my housemates was from Newcastle, and we would have lovely chats. But also, it's funny, I had a housemate from Newcastle and a housemate from North Devon, which is, right, it's the county but one out on the southwest leg of England. So again, I am pretty, you cannot really go any further south than I am, downwards. You can go southwest another like 4 hours. I wouldn't suggest that you necessarily do at this time of year, and I think even the people that live there would prefer that you don't. But it was a mixing pot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just interesting to see how, I think for you as somebody who is not from the UK, your kind of pretty accurate interpretation of how, yeah, as you, I would say that you kind of, it's a bit of an inverse bell curve of how nice people are as you go up England, because you kind of, you start, and I think down south, and I think people are polite and nice, and you go up towards Oxfordshire, and it goes down. And I'm not going to apologise for that, because people are more rude in like sort of Oxfordshire in the kind of the home counties, and then you kind of comes up again as you go more north.
Yeah, and people get friendlier and friendlier with each county as you
and
go
then
up.
And then you reach Scotland, and they're just really nice.
Oh, Scots people are great.
They are.
They're just lush. Yeah. I love them a bit. Yeah. Never letting your display go to sleep may shorten its life. I mean, same.
Same.
If I don't get enough sleep, I will also significantly shorten my life. Even though if I could not sleep, I would be so productive. The amount of things I could get done, mostly playing Animal Crossing.
Right, yes.
Do you think, like, a genuine question, like, if you do not, like, if you didn't have to sleep, do you mm-hmm. think you would be more productive? Or would you just spend more time doing random stuff?
I would just spend more time doing random stuff.
Yeah, me too.
I think that not having to sleep and having a constant stream of energy, I think, is obviously different. But in some ways, I kind of can't wrap my head around it. The kind of idea of never being tired, which I know sounds like because you're saying you don't have to sleep.
I'm always tired.
Yes. But I think it's more that, you know, I'm kind of like, well, yes, okay, I'm always tired, but just the idea of never wanting to rest as well. And I think, as you say, it's even when I feel at my most refreshed and ready, there is still a finite amount of quote-unquote productive stuff I can get done before I inevitably need to do something else.
I would go for a middle ground. If we could be like D&D elves, right? So the trick there is, so by default, you need to have like 8 hours of rest.
Yes.
As a D&D character.
Uh-huh.
Elves need to sleep only for 4. And okay. Their sleep is like, quote unquote, meditating. Is that really sleep? And then you have 4 hours that you still need to rest for it to count as a long rest, which yes. is a really key thing when you're playing Dungeons & Dragons. That to me sounds like the perfect middle ground of like, yeah. Like mm-hmm. So to have like dedicated 4 hours of just chilling sounds nice. And the only like requirement, like hard requirement you have for sleep to be only 4 hours. That sounds lovely.
Yeah, I feel like my hard, well.
Which by the way is not my hard
requirement. No, no, no.
My hard requirement is between 7 and 16.
Mine was 6, and that was before kids. And I think when going back to what we were, if you talk about, you know, offsites and SKOs, I can operate for like a few days on like 4 to 5 hours of sleep a night, if that's what I have.
I think operate is a good word to
operate
use.
Operate is the key word there.
Not thriving.
Not function. Operate. You know, minimum operate core functions only available. It's like when your laptop goes into power saver mode and it's like some functionality may be limited. That's me after 3 days of not getting any sleep. I think as though it comes as well into a quality over quantity of sleep.
Mm.
And 6 hours of good sleep for me. And then probably, again, from folks I've spoken to, it's true for most people. It probably is just chemically true in the brain that 6 hours of solid uninterrupted sleep is far better than 9 hours of interrupted sleep.
Oh yeah, not two ways about it.
And I think that's the problem as well, and I think it's something I'm making a conscious effort to do, is put myself into a position to have good sleep, basically. And things like reducing screen time, less screen time near when I'm about to go to bed, not sitting on my phone as literally the last thing I do before I go to sleep.
Like good sleep hygiene.
Yeah.
Which whilst I have done, and I know it's very effective, I find it really hard to do.
I find it really hard too.
It's just like, and it's not in the sense of like, I'm addicted to my phone, right? And I think you've noticed like over, obviously like the last like couple of days of us like, you know, actually hanging out in person. Like I'm not glued to my phone in any way, shape or form. But it's just one of those things that I've gotten into this habit of like, my relaxing time is right before bed. Mm-hmm. And my relaxing time tends to be watching, you know, stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that tends to then push that sleep hygiene a little bit out of the way for the sake of, ooh, I haven't watched the most recent episode of whatever series I'm watching on YouTube. It's like, yeah, I'm going to do that instead. And it's like, oh, it's 2 a.m. Oh, well. Oh, no.
I think this is a conversation we've had previously about not having YouTube on my phone and using the iPad. I will watch TV quite often before bed, and sometimes will fall asleep. Like I'll put the sleep timer on the TV and it will just be playing like old episodes of Family Guy or something. For me, that is different to being sat like scrolling on my phone. A, it's not blue light, and it's more of a, it's the same thing of like, because you're familiar with the thing, it's a way for me to sort of winding my brain down. Again, I don't always do it, but I also sometimes, and I've always, from when I was little, the way that my parents got me to stay in my bedroom when I was 4 or 5 was to have storybooks on tape.
Mm.
And I would listen to them.
Oh, the original podcasts.
The original podcasts. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I would listen to them, and I would go, and obviously because cassette tape, it comes to an end, it stops. So that's the original sleep timer, right? You just wait for the tape to run out. And I would do that, and I've done that for 30 years. And so I always have needed something, or most of the time, I need something playing to help me get off to sleep. And I've had the like weird pillow with a speaker in it, but it doesn't really work.
Oh, that sounds strange.
It was strange. The worst bit is because you can't wash it because there's obviously electronics in it. But it literally had like a 3.5mm jack
that
you plug in, and then you have the speaker. And it worked quite well because it's like when you're sharing a bed with somebody, you can't just have something on listening to. Now it does. I have also had that thing of like, I've been having wired headphones and I've woken up and they're like wrapped around my neck.
Not recommended.
Not an ideal thing. So if people have recommendations for, because I know a lot of people do this, people listen to podcasts and stuff to fall asleep to. If people have recommendations, if anyone used the like head, I think like the like almost like headbands that have it, please let me know.
So nerdy.
Please let me know, because I would love to find a way to just like listen to old audiobooks of like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or the Winnie the Pooh stories from when I was a kid, because you know what? Nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
And it sends me off to sleep. And I think it's that sleep hygiene, but I I told you this yesterday. Thinking about sort of sleep hygiene and habit hygiene, I randomly, kind of on a whim, kind of thought about, I deleted Instagram on my phone, and it wasn't because I was finding, it wasn't a conscious, I should be doing this. It was because I was finding, turning to your point, habitually, the first thing I was doing when I was waking up in the morning was picking up my phone, opening Instagram and scrolling reels, and doing so aimlessly. Yeah. And I think that was the point, and it got to the point where I was like sending my friends reels, and they would send me reels, and I'd be like, and I'd send a reaction, and I was like, hang on a minute, this, there's something wrong here, and I'm not getting any. And it's, again, it's not about, you know, oh, I, everything I watch or I consume has to somehow be informative or educational,
yeah,
right? But it has to have, you know, it has to just not be 3-second dopamine hits over and over and over and over and over and over again. So I think that's the thing, and it's why as well I have finally brought an e-reader after being someone who for whenever e-readers first came out 16 years ago, being like, oh, why don't I read a book on that? I want to read a physical book. To then going, oh, I can get web articles on there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I've read, like, more stuff in the last 24 hours since I got it than I have in ages, because it's just easier and nicer.
It's so interesting that the thing that got you into e-book reading is articles, because I would never... So, like, I got my Kindle, like, I have, like, one of the, like, older Kindles. Like, I got it when I was still in Bulgaria, so that's, like, more than 10 years. So it must have been one of, like, the first-ish ones. And it was just about, because I have very fond-esque memories of bringing, like, a beefy Raymond R. Feist book to school. And these things are chonky, right? They're a proper, like, fantasy, like, it's like a 3-book series in one book.
Mm-hmm.
And I would bring that in my in my school bag.
Yeah. Yeah,
Which was already incredibly heavy, and it didn't help in any way, shape, or form. And I was just, when that technology sort of came out, I'm like, this is, I want this to be the last, like, this is going to be the only book I carry around. Which, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I still have physical books, but most often than not, that has my default now for reading. And I'm surprised for someone who reads so incredibly much that you don't... Like, that it took you articles to actually switch over to the dark side of actually having an electronic medium.
Yeah, I think some of it, well, a lot of it is just my own personal affinity to, like, secondhand bookshops, which is, like, next to coffee shops is one of my just favourite places just to go and hang out in.
Such a hipster, honestly.
I did it before it was cool. And it also reminds me of it. It's because it's kind of how I did it when I was little. I grew up in reading and around libraries, borrowing library books, which I still do. And now and then, I obviously, when I was a student and I went to secondhand book, there was one of them, unfortunately, has gone now. One that I spent many hours in as a student. But going in, and I think it's the, you never know what you're going to find in there. Like, oh, this is a, I would never have thought of picking this book up. Like, oh, book by Dennis Wheatley, the founder of the Church of Satan, and it's fiction. Oh, hey, that sounds interesting. Like, because I think it's the discoverability for me still exists in physical books.
Yeah.
In going and browsing. And I think that's what I saw when, it's the same thing as buying physical music or movies, or any kind of physical media. You lose that discoverability when you go online. And everyone's had it when you're on, like, Netflix, and you're like, oh, there's so many things to watch, and I don't want to watch any of them, and what do I watch? And you spend half an hour scrolling and then turn the TV off and don't watch anything. Or you go to YouTube and watch clips of Last Week Tonight. I speak from experience. And it's that, but I think the thing that I have struggled with is, I've always liked reading, like, articles and magazines online more than... Because, yes, I've had magazine subscriptions in my time and kind of reading them cover to cover, but I'm much more likely to sort of go, oh, I'm going to go pick that one and pick that one and pick that one and pick that one. It's that sort of, like, ability to pick and choose what I want to read. That's what drew me to an e-reader. And it means I'm not doing it on my phone.
Yeah, which is always, it's always a goal to, like, limit usage of phones. Which I would say it is the most distracting piece of tech I have. Which is funnily to say that, well, when I carry, like, my Switch with me all the time, yet the phone is the problem. But again, we're facing against an adversary that is, you know, especially with these apps, like we cannot fight against them. It's just, there's so many smart people in there trying to make it so that we cannot put it down. It's like, yeah, that's an uphill battle right there. Question for you then, as someone who is such an avid reader, and I'm curious because you mentioned libraries, you mentioned secondhand shops. Are your parents avid readers? Or like the home you grew up? Like, was it like an avid reader?
My mum is, yes. My dad will read a book, but my mum is an avid reader. And always was.
Okay, so the thing I'm thinking here is, I wonder if it's a cultural thing where I have not seen a library. Like, I have not stepped in a library in Bulgaria at all. I'm sure they exist, and I'm sure people use them. It's just, I never did. And I think the reason for that was because Dad is a incredibly avid reader. Dangerously so. I quote him very often that there is the dangers of reading. Is that at some point you just get too many ideas in your head and then probably, you know, you start thinking too much about things. And it's like, well, you know, ignorance is bliss does not come into folks like that. So in reality, like, my exposure to books has always been home, because we had a huge library at home, right? Mm-hmm. Not a room on its own, but practically every nook and cranny that you can shove a book in, there was a book in there, right? And this was obviously because that started like collecting or like gathering books up from either other family members or, you know. And I remember, like, he went to a library. So there was a library in at his workplace at the port. And he would lend books from there. But most of the time, he would prefer just to actually buy them instead of lending them. Because then he would want to reread them at some point, and he wouldn't know if they're still going to be around or if someone else has lended them, right? It's that sort of thing. So, like, my access to books has always been through Dad having just a ridiculous amount of books around the house. That's really, like, you know, and I very clearly remember, because I'm a fairly, I would say, late reader. Like, I didn't get into reading at a very young age. Like, I got into books as a teenager, and then it was just a, you know, that's the sort of thing of like reading under your bed covers for like until like 5 a.m. Like that was my experience as a teenager. I was a riveting, the interesting teenager, and that was really like what spurred, because like obviously all of the things that I'm into nowadays is because those were the things that obviously Dad was into, you know, when we were living together. And it was that was really what dictated my, and to your point about like, and I think between the two of us, you have a much wider range, and now it makes sense that you had just access to secondhand shops, libraries, etc., where you have so many different categories, whilst I had the things that Dad was into.
Yes, yes.
Which was, you know, it was still quite wide, but for example, like most of the really interesting things he was reading was mostly fantasy, right? And that, you know, that turned into my love for high magic fantasy. Instead of, I you know, and even nowadays, like, I struggle to read autobiographies. I struggle to read non-historical non-fiction. Like, if it's history, again, because mm-hmm. of Dad, I do find it quite interesting. But any other genre, like, it feels like, ooh, this is so unfamiliar. It's like an alien landscape in a book. It's just like, I don't know how I feel. That's why I really love the thing that we did for like birthday month, where we like exchanged books, because like you introduced me to some categories of books that are just like, why did Paul send me this book? Why is this so weird? I think I'm into it. No, well.
I will be honest, and I guess as a kind of a coda to this conversation, yes, my parents read a lot, but their reading choices, like, my dad has like a couple of authors that he would read, like John Grisham. He would always buy the new one because he knew he liked his writing. And for me, for a while, an ex-girlfriend of mine brought me like a Michael Connelly, like, it was, she was like, oh, my dad's into these books, and it was a double, it was a crime writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, pulpy crime writing, and I got into those. I do acknowledge that, like, the books I sent you were mostly ones that I found when I was at university. So I went and I literally studied literature, and that is, and even more so my master's, and that is what sort of exposed me to this whole other world of types of books and types of genres, and the kind of stuff that you're like, this is really weird, that, so that sort of literary fiction, or the, which is the kind of the fictional non-fiction sort of style and the fictional biography stuff. And autobiographies, like, I listen to them, right? I kind of, but I'm very selective about whose they are. So, like, Louis Theroux, I've enjoyed his because it's him reading them, and I kind of just quite like listening to how he reads them. But I wouldn't kind of go and say what I like is autobiographies. So that's it. I think it's as to your point, it's so much a product of the environment that you grow up in determines what you're engaged in and how you engage with that medium and the mediums that you consume it.
We're a full electronic book household now. There is no, especially since my parents like moved countries. And I think that's the other thing, that you, as people, we do have the tendency to hoard when we don't think about moving. Because I have moved now 2 times and I'm going to be moving a 3rd time. My parents have moved countries. One of the first things that gets lost along the way is books.
Yeah.
Because they are heavy physically, but also as a mental thing. It's like, you know, do I want to... It's the first thing you sort of question, especially when you do have access to the same works in an electronic form. It's like, do I really want to carry this physical load with me as I move across Europe? Is like, well, maybe not.
I think the other thing I will say is that it's one of those things where having an e-reader means that I will travel lighter.
Mm-hmm.
From now on, I won't shove 3 books in my bag when I'm going away for a week for fear that I might. And I have always had that perpetual fear of, what if I end up somewhere I don't have anything to read? It sounds irrational, but it's true. But actually having something that is incredibly lightweight. If anyone interested, not sponsored, but I went for the Kobo Libra colour. The colour was just the edition, and I wanted one that had buttons. Honestly.
Like proper tactile.
Proper tactile buttons, and it has, there's some other kind of features, but it was just, of all the choices, I didn't want to be tied into a single ecosystem, which, yep, if you buy the other big branded e-reader, the one that everyone knows, you are. But without wanting to get into a conversation now of the physical versus digital medium and the ownership and the ups and downsides and takes on that, it's probably worth saying that I had a, and we're probably going to come back to this in AI therapy. When we cut to AI therapy today, my experience of trying to find which one to buy was a total nightmare. And it's kind of AI therapy, but it's also kind of the topic that we're going to talk about today.
Speaking of inevitably disappointing. Talk to me about the topic you actually bring onto the table today, which, thank you. One of us had to put in the brain power to do that, and it was not going to be me, because I think I left my brain power somewhere on the A1. Why? And I'm very fascinated by this, because I am a avid YouTube user. Yet when you said this to me a couple of days back, I'm like, oh really? This is a problem that people have? So, YouTube reviews. Talk to me, Paul. What's happening in that world?
I feel like it's a recent phenomenon. And that's because... And I was trying to think, when was the last time I tried to research a significant purchase? And I honestly, it probably is at least a year ago. Maybe more.
By the way, how do you research purchases? Because I feel like, I'm going to make a stereotype here, that you are quite the explorer in the sense of, like, you look at reviews, you read things, you compare things, you make a well-educated purchase.
So if I give you a very extreme example, when I was younger and I was making decisions about whether or not to buy a CD, bearing in mind CDs, I could afford to buy one album a month because they cost about £17 in 2001, so like 35 quid today. I remember borrowing the CD from a friend of mine, listening to it front to back multiple times over several days to inform if I really wanted to go and spend my money. So that's the kind of where with the starting point, right? And you said a stereotype, but I think I don't read reviews in, like, I'm not kind of going and reading TechCrunch or The Verge or Wired to go, what did this established, you know, institutions think about this thing? Because they're going to give me a perspective, because a review is always a perspective on something, and it's always obviously subjective. What I'm more likely to do is I might do that if I'm sort of wanting to. That always comes in like the point of where I'm going, I think I've made my decision, I now want to affirm it. Example of e-readers, right? I was like, I had a criteria in my head of what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking at the Books Palmer, which is an overpriced device. and is running a version of Android that's out of support. But the appeals of which were, it was e-ink, it ran, I can read articles, I can read books, should I want to. It did obviously have the option to also play audiobooks and podcasts and be able to kind of go out without my phone, right? Okay. I didn't go for that in the end, and I think that's obviously kind of largely down to the fact that it's out of support rather than the price. I think I could justify the price when you compare it, when you benchmark it against other devices in the space and what you get for your money with it. I also think it's probably actually a little bit too small. It's one of the kind of thing that I go, if I really get into e-reading or a larger e-reader, and I go, you know what I want is I want something I can put in my pocket, not in my bag, then that kind of device is where I'll get to. But I started with, this is something that I really like the idea of, and this is something that will get me into e-reading. From there, I'll kind of go and be like, what are the e-readers of what, to you know, Arc Search or ChatGPT, pick your AI search of choice, and go, what e-readers allow me to do this? So I know I want what device type I want, I know what I want it to be able to do. And from there, I will go, and I thought, right, what I'm going to do, oh, okay, the Kobo looks good, right? It's not locked into an ecosystem, it has this. I want to watch some reviews, because I find YouTube reviewers have been for some time, have been a good source because they get hands-on, you can kind of get to know their perspectives, and you also get to see that they'll sort of, different people will do, they'll do comparative reviews, they'll do, here are the top five of the available, here are the differentiators. So that's how I'll approach buying. So kind of how I would say you're 80% of the way there when you ask my stereotype of how I buy. Yes, I do my research, but I kind of go in with an idea of what I will start from a place of, I have seen, or a friend has, or I've heard about something. The reviews themselves, however,
right,
were a quagmire of quite obviously AI-generated scripts.
Ooh.
And audio and video.
Ooh.
Here are the top five e-readers in June of 2024.
Oh, no.
And zero value.
Right. Yeah, because it's just generated gibberish.
Mm-hmm. Clickbait.
Oh, man. Yeah, see, like, I haven't looked into... So I do have some... Because when you said YouTube reviews, I thought you were referring to the genre of YouTube, which is tech reviews. Is like folks who are known for, you know, taking a piece of tech and pushing it to its limits, doing the, you know, benchmarks, doing like, you know, this is where this device lands in the tech landscape at the moment. And I do have like a couple of YouTubers that I follow that, you know, do that sort of thing. I don't watch them religiously because I'm not looking to be sold on a product. But it is one of those things where, like, that was my impression of where, like, where the world is right now. And then, but I've never done what you've done, which is like, oh, I'm looking for a product in a group of products, like let's say, like, you know, ebook readers, and then try to find comparative, informative sort of information. It's always, you know, for example, like, you know, the most recent review, quote unquote, I watched was someone just talking through what Apple are doing with their, like, the most recent lineup. And that was interesting. I'm not looking to purchase anything at the moment, but it was informative and interesting, and to the degree of quality that I would also have it just as an enjoyable watch time. Whilst I'm not hearing, obviously, that's not the experience you had.
It's there. I got to it eventually.
Oh, right. So do you think then that YouTube is actually pushing this content more, like the cheaper, let's call it cheaper, because it is cheaper, sort of like nutritionless
content first? That was my impression, was right. I had to break through this layer of just terrible, unhelpful, uninformative garbage to get to what I wanted to do. And I think it's a sign of just, in some ways, how sort of diluted that's becoming. So as you say, what you're talking about is what I was looking for.
Yep.
I wanted people who would, and I've eventually found channels whose entire thing was built around e-readers and
benchmarking. That was what I was wondering, if because like I don't know, I don't have a top of my head, a YouTuber who specializes in ebooks, right? It's one of those things that you don't do. Whilst again, looking at my own behavior of watching this sort of content and looking at, for example, my partner and how, because he watches a lot of game reviews, he has like 3 YouTubers that he knows or has seen their opinions over many years. And whilst he doesn't sort of subscribe to like, oh, whatever this person says, like that's the truth, right? As you said, like they're quite subjective opinions. But he knows, like, listening to this person is like, oh, this person likes, over the years he has understood, like, these are the things that this person likes. So if he says that, for example, a game is not to his liking, then my partner will make the assumption is like, oh, I now know where this game stands because of the fact that he doesn't like it.
Yes.
So that's but that's a different thing, and that's like the whole, you know, and this is where I think like these tech reviewers have a really high value to us consumers, because you get to know the person. It's very similar to having like a virtual friend. I said, like, you know, someone that has tried it out, you know where they stand, you know what their values are, you know how they actually do things, and that actually helps with you making a more informed decision. I've never actually looked up, like actually even seen these like top 10.
No, and it's interesting you mention like game reviewers. I would put, there's a couple of like movie reviewers that I
put. Yeah.
And
same, I'm
like,
thing.
And there are things that I know, and I can think of a couple of, so well, I don't mention, right? So in terms of like tech, Unbox Therapy, very famous tech YouTuber, but I know he comes at things, as you say, with a certain perspective.
Yeah.
Zero Punctuation for gaming. Right, he's coming at things with a certain perspective, and I know and have followed his content, not religiously, as you say, but I know enough about what he likes, or Mark Kermode, the film reviewer, I know enough about his taste in film to know that if he says, I didn't find this funny, I probably also won't find it funny.
Yeah, that's one thing that you match with him.
We match with him, but there are then things that he likes, I'm like, no. And then I know, and there are people who have written into his show that are like, I listen to you because I know that I am the antithesis of you in my taste. So if you love something, I know I'll hate it, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And I think my concern is that kind of organic, thoughtful YouTube content is getting suppressed and will continue to be, because what gets the clicks is the top 10 or the top 5 or these things compared. And it particularly when I got into the comparisons, because again, that's something you would think a tech reviewer would compare. Say I was looking at, I want to get a new camera. Okay, what's the Sony versus the Canon versus the Nikon? And they would compare them, and they would talk about in depth the similarities, the differences, the nuances, if you like this type then you like this, rather than just, this is the specifications and it does this, this is this. And I was like, but that's no help to me, because I want someone's subjective opinion on this to help me make a decision.
So do you think YouTube is going down the drain?
I think it's becoming harder to find good content when you don't know what you're looking for, or you don't know who you... I would make the same analogy about the internet, and it's why I have started using services like RSS readers again to sort of curate my experience into a single place. I think it's becoming harder to find the content you want. It's still out there.
That's really interesting. I wonder if it's because it's cheap content to make and it's just overwhelming the platform. But at the same time, and I don't know if this is everyone's experience, it feels like the algorithm, like YouTube's algorithm, has now changed. And by the way, like, I'm quite sensitive to the YouTube algorithm purely because it is one of my, like, it's one of the topics I'm quite fascinated by. Like, video content and the redistribution of video content is like a science of its own. And the way YouTube do it, the way, you know, Google does it, is a very odd phenomena, because it's almost like a natural, like not a natural, but like an organic beast that has behavior changes that seem like there isn't really a good explanation, but obviously somewhere tweaked something to make it now more desirable to do this and the other. So for example, like when you say, like, you know, obviously like cheap content might be being pushed out, at the same time, my personal experience of being on the platform is long form quality content is actually on the rise, which I enjoy quite a lot, because I am one of these people that would watch a video on demand of a live stream.
Mm-hmm. Right, like I would mm-hmm. watch mm-hmm. and have something in the background for like 6 hours straight of someone either just chatting, just talking, just playing, just doing whatever. So I am definitely in this demographic of this is the people that YouTube want to put themselves in front of, because at the end of the day, it makes them more money, right? It's always about money at the end of the day. So I'm quite both surprised, yet if I sort of logic my way into it, I can see why the cheap content would still be up and about. It's just quantity. Mm-hmm. It's less about, is the algorithm really favoring it? It's just, there is so much because it's so easy to make. And you just push and push and push until obviously, like, you know, you can make, when you can make 1,000 videos, even if they have like 1,000 views each, that's still a big number of total views that you're getting as a channel versus making one really good one and it gets 1 million views.
Yes.
But is YouTube really pushing that? I don't think so. I think it's just suddenly access to tools to make this a lot easier.
Yes. And I think, and you're right, there's a proliferation of that. And it wasn't that YouTube was pushing it, but it was what was coming up when I was, it was what was coming up first when I'm searching.
Yeah.
And I agree as well, there's like a bifurcation of content, particularly on YouTube. And it's interesting you mentioned like 6 hour videos and long form. Because YouTube is going in the, and there is still a section of YouTubers who do sort of that, what I think of as classic YouTube. Bearing in mind, obviously, early YouTube videos, the max length was 10 minutes. So there's still some content out there. There's a few kind of quite big name YouTubers that have quit recently because they were finding that they were doing that sort of conventional 5 to 6 minute medium form content. They couldn't compete with the AI generated stuff in that space.
Yeah.
And they weren't wanting to do this like the 2 hour video essay or documentary. And YouTube is kind of bifurcating into shorts, which are, again, absolutely AI generated. And there's so many things which are like, oh, we have this pop star and you'll never believe the thing that they said. And it's just like terrible phone footage with, like I say, some AI generated voice over the top. Or, and people are either consuming that, or as you say, they're doing what you're doing and what I do, which is you put on a long video, or I mean, when I consume video essays, it kind of tends to be in chunks, right? I watch like 20 minutes and 20 minutes and 20 minutes. And the creators absolutely are going in the long form direction, which I love, right? I think it's great. I think the access to technology to create that kind of stuff, the fact that there's an audience for it is fantastic.
Yeah.
But in the space that's getting squeezed is that like videos that are, let's say, 8 to 15 minutes in length, which are reviews or, and not just reviews, but that, and this is my personal experience of it, and what I see. And as you say, I think it's not, coming back to it, it's not that YouTube is intentionally pushing AI generated content, as far as I know. It's just that's the stuff that has the titles that are getting the clicks, so therefore it's pushing it up the search results.
There is a term, and I was just now trying to sneakily search for it as I was listening to you. There is a term in it's an economics term about the middle of economies, where over time the natural way that, in this case, let's think about physical products, right? If we look back 20 years ago, there was a slew of options of, like, you know, let's say chairs. There was a middle ground where you can have both quality of a product, choice, and a good medium price. Whilst over time that is pushed from having that like nice cozy middle to the two extremes, because you either make a lot very cheap, so you're actually making margin on like just selling a ton of really cheap chairs, or you go into the other end of that spectrum, which is bespoke, custom, handmade, incredibly expensive and luxurious items, but you are losing that middle. And I don't know if you've noticed that in life in general, that you are really starting to miss that middle section. And I'm so annoyed, if I remember what the term is, I'll put it in the show notes. But that same sort of perspective is actually moving into content as well, where, and you can see that in YouTube, where you either have really short, really high quality, really snappy content, including, like, you know, the likes of Mr. Beast, right? Who is like the top YouTuber at the moment. I think he's still like leading the top. Where you have like that like short, snappy, high quality content. And then you have, on the other end of that spectrum, the 6 hours documentary that people spend months on doing. You know, and I'm not obviously like taking away from like the shorts, like the short content is also incredibly good. But that's what you were talking about there, and a lot of content creators like found themselves burning out because that
nice middle ground of 15 to 20 to 30 minute content is starting to become like that cozy middle that just for economics reasons is being pushed out mm-hmm. of that. Are you trying to...
I think I found... This is
oh, the missing middle.
The missing
yes,
middle.
It is the missing middle. Yes. Thank you so much. Well, your Google foo is much better than mine. Especially when I'm trying to be quiet. but yeah, that missing middle is so obvious in physical products, but it's also moving into the digital side of things as well. And I think it's also the same with written content as well. I don't know if you've noticed this, but the even though there is a resurgence of... Is it a revolution of blogging? Is it a resurgence of blogging?
It's the thing that I think I might have mentioned before. The internet is getting smaller again. In so far as the internet when... And blogging, right? I've written about this before. When the internet kind of... The first of, you know, Web 1.0, Web 2.0... It's all about these sort of small, global, but quite small personal communities that you build. Then the rise of social media in the early 2000s, suddenly you had access to the entire world. Oh, and I think, and Twitter is a great example of this. It's global town square. And as we're now, and you can argue that is X going away, is it not? Certainly recent events in the UK have led to an increasing number of people leaving that platform.
But the UK was never a big market for it anyway.
It wasn't. But in terms of the audience, the kind of people that are on there.
Yeah.
Right. It's. But what's happened is that it's not like... So again, I guess I remember when we went from this sort of disparate different social networks, everyone suddenly was on MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
And then from MySpace, we went to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And then Facebook, we went to Instagram. And some people kind of got Twitter. And then that's kind of now. And then you can argue, and then that, since then, there has not been another sort of platform shift. It's not a platform shift. A platform shift is moving from like a laptop to a phone. There's not been another sort of site where everyone has migrated, where the majority of people have migrated to. People have now gone off to other... They're either on Threads, or they're on Blue Sky, or they're on Mastodon, or they're not on it at all. You know, I've got friends who have just essentially, like, in all essence, quit social media. And not intentionally gone, I'm coming off of social media. They've just kind of stopped using it.
Yeah.
Right, and now they just use WhatsApp because again, and some of that is because I think people are aging out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, as you get older, your friendship group gets smaller again, and you start to really just stay closer to fewer people. But I think it's the same with like things like newsletters and journalists and blogging, and it's that tendency of moving towards longer form, more engaging, more targeted content. And as consumers, we are consuming from fewer sources. It's much more like, and I think, you know, I'm not reading 20, 30 people anymore. I'm reading 5.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think there is a missing middle appearing in that you've either got people writing for massive publications, or you've got a small subset on particular social media networks, and I've now curated certain people that I follow and engage with on those.
I think saying that the middle in that sense was social media.
I think it was, yes.
Like the traditional yes. use of social media. Yes. Like, you know, and I'm not talking about social media nowadays, I'm talking about like when it was at, I would say when it was at its peak, which
I'm
is
talking
like,
2010 to 2012.
Yeah.
I would say.
That's an interesting take, because I think I am one of those people who have stepped away from social media quite organically. Like I never had this, I never felt like it was sucking my life away anyway. So I never had this like, oh, I need to go off social media. I sort of organically stopped using multiple platforms. And even now, and I'll be honest with you, like even nowadays, LinkedIn is getting into that path as well, because, and it is about what am I getting out of this? And it's getting less and less. Nowadays, like it is a communication tool. It is practically, this is, you know, I have this social media to reach out to these people. I have this social media to reach out to these people. I have WhatsApp to reach out to the other people. But it's not about consuming as much anymore. To be honest with you, like you are my best source for LinkedIn things, because I just don't even have the desire anymore to scroll through things anymore and just look at what's happening. I am yet to really sort of engage with a lot of written material as well, and I think it's just an attention thing. Like I haven't had really the time to curate that, but in my head, that's always the thing of like, oh, I want to, like, and it's a very often thought of, like, oh, I need to sit down and actually pick some folks to, like, read from and like, learn from and everything else. Because nowadays, just most of my content is audio, right? You know, I'm a big podcast listener. And I feel like I'm getting that need that I have of keeping in touch with what's happening in the world in the areas that I'm interested in. I do it via podcasts nowadays. Which is, you know, you can argue that some of them is practically what a lot of written material can easily then be pushed into a podcasting, you know, platform. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but that idea of the missing middle, like, since I was introduced to that idea, it's just, I keep on seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it might have, I think it applies to YouTube. I think it applies to general content absorption and obviously physical things.
And I think, yeah, and it's interesting because this is getting very highbrow. I'm scanning the abstract of an academic economics paper. But essentially, where I think you can translate this from the economics, which is, as you say, that missing middle of, and maybe it's the decline of the middle class as well, as a concept of people who have a well-paid job and a nice hat. It's like, the quote-unquote nuclear family, nice house, two kids, two cars, one main income, right? That is going away. Like, it's the people always go, how much money was Homer Simpson on at the nuclear power plant that he could have this massive house, three kids, a wife that didn't work, two pets and two cars, and, you know, never seemed to have economic hardship, right? There was kind of hints at it, but again, it's the, like, that sort, but it was funny because people could relate to that sort of life, and that just doesn't exist anymore. And I think when you translate across to content, and this may be a bit crass, right? But you sort of go, there are people either at the end who are, just as you say, and I would probably put myself in this as well. Might not seem like it to folks who see me active on LinkedIn, but my LinkedIn use is very intentional and very purposeful. I'm not doing it because I'm trying to... I'm not using it in the way that I've used social media before in terms of keeping up with people. I'm using it to build a network and build connections.
Yeah.
And to share my own experiences with others. And so who are people like you and I who were sort of just falling off this bottom, not really consuming. And then on the other end, there were the people that are scrolling TikTok, scrolling Instagram, that are really high consumers. And, you know, some of them, and we were joking yesterday, right, that I went to put something on Facebook Marketplace recently and felt like I was stepping back about 10 years because there's people who I'm... Because I deactivated my account 7-8 years ago. Stopped using it. Who were people who are, again, still using it like it's the way I did 10-12 years ago. And that kind of high end of social media use is still there. But that those people who consumed but never posted...
Yep.
is going away. Like, I had been that person for a long... Like, Instagram is a... perfect example. In the last 2 years, I had posted to my stories maybe 4 times, 5 times, and pretty much all of those were like a song I was listening to in Spotify because I was like, oh, look, a heavy, like a death metal song's come on because I'm in the gym. And that was all I was posting. And the last time I posted to the grid comfortably over 2 years ago, it's just not something I'm doing anymore because I have less than zero interest in doing it.
Yeah.
And again, I get nothing out of it.
Mm.
So... It's
are we just getting old?
No, because there's people that are older than us who are still using it in that way. I think it's maybe some of it is because we are people who work with technology.
We know how the sausage is made, and we feel.
But not even that. I think we're in front of screens 8 hours a day.
Mm.
And if I think about people who are, and not to stereotype, but when I think about the kind of people that were more active on these platforms. They were people who were nurses, doctors, teachers, police officers. They might be knowledge workers, right? But they weren't sort of surrounded by technology in the same way that we are. So they're perhaps not as
sensitive.
Yeah, maybe kind of exposed to it, sort of tired of it, right? Like for us, and it's the joke of I go from big sad screen. To little happy screen whilst watching bigger happy screen, right? Which was kind of the default for a while. And again, it comes back to like, why have I brought an e-reader? I brought an e-reader because I felt like I had built this habit up that was built around a device and I felt locked into it. So maybe we are getting old, or maybe we're just, as you say, not. If we're not getting value out of it, then why are we engaging with it? I feel like, and I may be completely wrong, and I'm willing to be wrong, I've been wrong before on this, but I wonder if there is a solution to this whole problem of the growing amount of content that exists. A lot of it being AI generated, I admit. But this inability to find what you're looking for on the internet, particularly when we see that like Google has actively not improved search and the search experience has gotten actively worse. And it's obviously quite ironic what I'm about to say.
Go on.
But I think that AI might be the answer to some of it. Insofar as what are large language models good at? Reviewing, summarizing, and extracting the high level summary out of a huge amount of content. And I think it's something I've been mulling this over for a while. I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts about it. And we always do it. We do AI therapy, and it's kind of a bit of a like, haha, this is the AI story. And it is a little bit of the like, oh, AI is now in everything because that's going to make us more money. But what it ignores is what I still see, and we're 2 years into this now, as the most practical application of this technology, which is huge amounts of information out there. Please create a custom search, so feed in all this academic information, review information, summarize all the reviews and the videos and everything that is out there on the internet, because I think whilst the experience of watching these AI videos is painful, the content is factual in there, and so far as it does review, it does give me the specs of these things. But what I don't want to have to do is sit through a 15-minute AI generated and voice video. But if that content summary, and as a research tool, not as the whole answer, and I think that's crucial to say, because I think people seem to think it's the whole answer to everything, and that you can just suddenly use AI to answer all the questions you ever had. Absolutely not, but it is a jumping off point.
So what is your specific question there? Because I agree with a lot of what you said.
I wonder what you think. Do you think okay, so you say you agree. What do you agree with and what do you disagree with?
So I agree with the, is it a tool for summarization? Yes, it does that from my personal experience quite well. Is it a method of searching through information in the sense of, as you said, like looking through and comparing specs of different products, different things, like give me like a summary of like what's the difference between like the two most recent versions of the iPhone, let's say. Absolutely, yeah, I would use, you know, GPT search or the Gemini for that sort of thing. Absolutely, if I know it's going to be factual, which, you know, there goes one of my my criticisms towards that. Are we, especially when you first start, like when you started talking, like you saw me smile at you because I'm like, I thought the direction you're going to take is, are we going to use AI hunters to find AI stuff? Which is like, are we going to use these tools to figure out what is AI generated, what is useful, what is going to be worth watching and worth checking into by using other tools to prevent that? Which is a funny thing to think about.
Yes.
Highly possible. I would use that for that.
The risk is that you end up, garbage generates more garbage.
Well, yeah, but that's the ultimate fear that we have with these things.
Mm.
It's like, because like at this point, it's still being fed human produced content.
Mm.
At some point, and this is a theory, right? The theory is it's going to keep on churning and keep on churning until it starts feeding itself. It's like, okay, what's going to happen then? I don't know. What are we going to do then? I also don't know. The reality of right now is, then to your point, and the more we talk about this, like, you know, the internet getting smaller, the more I am agreeing with you, because I think that is really the answer to how do we avoid spending 15 minutes watching a garbage video.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you find people.
Mm-hmm.
You find your little group, a forum even, that you can have these conversations or this content produced by someone that you have or know of a lot more, a lot deeper.
And I think it allows you to narrow the search that you're looking for, to specify what it is. And that was the challenge I had, was I was going so broad that I'm not saying it was the YouTube algorithm's fault that that's what I was coming to, but that's what was being prioritized.
Would you think that instead of you looking for a video, would it be worth, and because this is a true use case that I see something like the chat bots being there, like AI powered chat bots, is instead of that, if you're going on, let's say, Amazon, right, you go on Amazon and you say like, I'm looking at ebooks, these are my requirements, give me some options.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that's a far better use case instead of you looking through content, is to have that set of tooling.
Yes, yes. And that is a far better answer. You just articulated in about 30 seconds what it took me 4 minutes to try and explain. Exactly that. Here are my requirements. Here's what I'm looking for. Here's my budget. Tell me what my options are and compare them. And then I can take... Once I'd landed on three models, I could then go and seek out human-generated content and human-generated... actual human reviews. Human-generated, that sounds weird. Human-created and actual human reviews of these devices, because that's what exists. And it's enabling, using that AI tool as an enabler to cut through the noise of information down to...
You know what you're looking for, Paul?
What am I looking for?
You're looking for a pre-sales person. Pre-sales boss, I am looking for this specific thing. It's quite a lot of options out there, and what my requirements are quite complicated. Can you give me a summary of what actually I'm looking for? Thanks, pre-sales boss.
Not that we're saying that pre-sales people are going to be replaced by AI anytime soon.
Unless they do exactly that.
But I do think it comes back to the problem statement at the beginning was trying to buy consumer stuff now sucks even more than it did before. Because trying to get to the information that I'm after is harder, because previously I would have searched for, you know, good e-readers to read articles, and I would have been returned content that people had made that through SEO, right, through metadata, fulfilled those requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Now I kind of need AI to get over the fact that there's a bunch of this clickbaity stuff in the middle.
Yes.
To get me to narrow down, right, this is what I'm looking for.
AI pre-sales person.
Yeah.
Consumer-based pre-sales person. That's what you're looking for. This is how you know I'm firing on all cylinders. It's like whenever you have like a whole like spiel that you want to talk to people about, it's like, whoop, that's the thing.
It's that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know.
I just needed a walk.
You did. No, it is that, and I think it's the... And maybe then, okay, if you're somebody who buys stuff, and I'd be curious to hear this. Next time you go to buy something, whether it be for you, whether it be some technology for your company, I want to hear if you've managed to use AI to be that buyer enablement piece, to be the pre-sales person, mm-hmm. to help you discern what it is you're actually looking for.
Yeah, I can answer you that,
uh-huh.
because I did do that.
Okay.
For what are we going to use for, like, internal chats.
Okay.
That was literally the process I went through.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were looking at Slack, Teams, etc. Like, what are we going to... Discord. What are the things that you and I, Paul, are going to use for project/worky things that we're working on together?
Mm-hmm.
And I literally went to ChatGPT and went like, this is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is the size of the team that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
These are my requirements. This is what we're currently using, right? To your point about being pre-sales, it's like, this is the landscape, like the tech landscape that I have as a business. Help. Literally, first answer is... You're using Google Suite. Use Google Chat. That is very fair. Thank you, ChatGPT. Move on. So yes, there's definitely a use case for that.
Mm.
And to the point that, and to tie this conversation into, obviously, you know, I jokingly say you need an AI pre-sales person, but in reality, really, that is the use case that I see for things like ChatGPT and these, you know, and these tools going forward within this space. It's like, yeah, to the point of, and we talk about this when it comes to buyer enablement, right? Like, before you purchase something, I literally did that. I did my research. I'm 80% of the way there before I, like, potentially even talking to a person. In this case, I'm not even going to talk to a person. I've made my decision based on research. And that research can be, you know, heavily helped by AI. AI chatbots.
There we go.
Your new pre-sales colleague.
Your new pre-sales, and there we are. Your new... buying assistant. And I think that's it. That feels to me like a tangible, real, applicable and realistic use of the technology. And I just wish we'd stop trying to do other stuff with it.
Stop creating content.
Start searching it. Tom, if you're listening to this, if you're enjoying the show, it really does help if you like, subscribe, share, comment, or just even tell one other person to check it out. We really hope you're enjoying what we're doing here. We really love making it, and we've actually got some really exciting stuff planned for what we're going to do next with The Wandering Tech.
Excitement!
Whoop, 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 excitement klaxon! But no, seriously, we're both really excited about the next phase. Phase, yeah, phase. That sounds good. We've come out of phase one. We're going into phase two of the Wandering Tech universe, and it's going to be really cool. And we'd love it if more people could hear it.
Thanks for supporting us.